Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And my name is Tom Anyamba, Professor of Architecture, University of Nairobi. Been teaching for the last 31 years.
This week's episode was recorded in Nairobi as part of a series of episodes we're bringing you from East Africa to explore ideas around identity and architecture. Identity is the theme of this year's London Festival of Architecture.
Resilience, yeah, and character. And we say architecture is 10% intellect and 90% sweat. Because to make your idea really work, you must really engage.
On the programme this week, we speak to Professor Tom Anyamba, Dean of the University of Nairobi's School of the Built Environment.
The kind of curriculum I went through myself was completely Eurocentric, Western-oriented. But right now we're beginning to emphasize on African cultures. So we're going back into history and beginning to bring about this, you know, traditional African architecture, and how it can be adapted in the city. It is not a very easy transition, because you find that the foundations of our urban architecture were basically Eurocentric.
The University of Nairobi started life as the Royal Technical College in 1956, before Kenyan independence in 1963, initially issuing degrees backed by the University of London. Tom originally studied architecture at the University of Nairobi before working for Richard Hughes and Partners in Nairobi. He subsequently left Kenya to take his master's degree at the Helsinki University of Technology, now Alvar Aalto University, then going on to complete his PhD in Oslo in Norway. He now leads the University of Nairobi School of Architecture, the oldest of just four universities teaching architecture in Kenya, where he's taught for over 30 years. I joined Tom in his office in Nairobi, where I started by asking about the history of the university.
And so the University of Nairobi is the oldest school of architecture in the region.
Yeah, okay. It started in 1956 as part of the Royal Technical College.
Right, okay.
Yeah, yes.
So before Kenyan independence?
Before independence.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, it became... that time they used to offer London University diplomas, and then eventually it became a department offering their own degrees.
Okay.
After independence.
Okay.
As part of the University of East Africa.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, how many students are here now? What's the sort of
in the Department of Architecture? I think right now we have about 800 students.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a big department.
Yeah, they become big in recent times. Before we used to have just about 200 to 300. But in recent times, we have enrolled quite a number.
Well, that's a really positive story. We'll come on to that a little bit later on then.
Yeah.
So you started here in 1981, did you say?
No, 87. I started teaching.
You started teaching here?
87. Okay. But I'm an old student here.
Ah, okay.
I studied here from 1975 to 1980.
Wow, okay.
Graduated.
And you studied architecture here?
I studied architecture. I graduated with a Bachelor of Architecture.
Okay.
And then I joined a practice in town.
Okay.
A practice of Richard Hughes and Partners.
Right.
Richard Hughes is an old student of the AA School of Architecture.
Right.
Yeah, a graduate of AA.
Okay.
He practiced here and we did quite a number of projects in the city here.
Right. So after graduating, you practiced as an architect in Kenya?
Yeah, and I got registered.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what sort of buildings did you design? Do you remember those?
I was at Richard Hughes, I worked on two big buildings in town. One of them is the ICEA building on Kenyatta Avenue.
The ICA?
ICEA.
ICEA,
Insurance Company of East Africa.
Okay.
And then we also did the National Bank building
on
Harambe Avenue.
Okay.
So those are the big projects I worked on while at Richard Hughes.
And Richard was, he was English originally.
He's retired. He's back in London.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. And is the practice still going?
No, he really, he wound up the practice.
Right,
And handed over his... Yeah. his businesses to another firm, Douglas Marshall.
Okay.
Yeah, which is also a British company.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I'm really interested in some of the people we've been speaking to about the process of, obviously there's that legacy of British people setting up practices and how, like Triad Architects, they've now become
local.
More or less. And now we're speaking to some other practices, I think later on, about younger Kenyans coming through, having been taught. Because I guess a lot of architects have gone abroad for training.
Yes.
So I'm kind of interested in how people are setting up, some of your students now going on to run their own practices. Are there? You must have seen a number of architects coming through.
Yeah. What happens is that after graduation, it's a requirement that you do at least 2 years of pupillage.
Okay.
Before you sit the BORACS. BORACS is Board of Architects and Quantity Surveyors Registration. Okay. Yeah. Before you sit, and then once you sit, then you can get registered, and then you are given the license now to practice on your own.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like for example, myself after working for Richard Hughes, I also set up my own private practice, which still runs even today.
Ah. Okay. Yeah. So
I double up. So I'm okay. You can say I'm straddling one leg in academia, another leg in practice.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's really good, I guess, for teaching.
That for teaching, you know,
grounded
that,
you in
know,
reality.
Architecture being a making profession.
Yeah.
You know, the practice only enhances your teaching capability.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, what sort of buildings do you? What sort of projects do you work on in the practice?
I've been doing most residential buildings. Done a few office blocks.
Okay.
We also did a collaboration between myself and my colleague in Durban, Natal.
Yeah.
We designed the Austrian Embassy, which is just on Limuru Road.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's quite a commission to win.
That was quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah. With a colleague from South Africa.
From South Africa.
Okay.
Yeah. Who used to teach with me here before he migrated.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a collaboration. I've also done quite a number of what you may call resorts.
Okay.
This kind of
hotel.
Hotel.
Okay.
Yeah.
And presumably some money in obviously building new hotel resorts. Tourism is a big industry.
Yes.
And so there's
it's
an interesting
big.
Client.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then one of the interesting projects I did was in 2001.
Okay.
I redesigned Jomo Kenyatta Sports Grounds in Kisumu City.
Yeah. Okay.
That is the major gathering
third city
space
in Kenya.
Yes.
Kisumu. Okay.
Yeah. And I worked in collaboration with a landscape architect from Port Elizabeth,
right,
in South Africa.
Okay,
yeah,
and that South African kind of influence is interesting. We see South Africa being perhaps the kind of powerhouse, economic powerhouse in Africa.
Yes,
are South African architects increasingly? I mean, all architects try and win work overseas.
Yes,
is there a strong South African influence
in recent times? From the 2000s, they're beginning to quite a number of. South African architects are doing work here in Nairobi. But if you look in history, the South African influence was always here. If you look at the Nairobi master plan for the colonial city of 1948, it was done by South African consultants, Thornton Inn and his company from Cape Town.
Okay.
They did that master plan.
Right.
So and that master plan really guided the development of Nairobi. And we haven't really had another serious master plan like that. We tried the Metropolitan Growth Strategy in 1973, but it was never quite implemented. Now we're trying something else they're calling the NIO Plan, Nairobi Integrated Urban Development Plan, which was promulgated in 2014, but it has not quite been realized.
And has that been the kind of the master plan being developed by Kenyan architects?
It is being developed by our planners and architects in collaboration with the JICA, Japanese International Cooperation Agency.
Right, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting the Japanese working or kind of collaborating in Kenya.
Yes.
I guess the thing a lot of people notice is the Chinese involvement now.
The Chinese have come in mostly as contractors.
Right.
Not as consultants.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're coming in to do the building.
They do the building, the actual construction. Okay. And I think for some reason they seem to bid. Their bids are quite competitive.
Right. Okay.
I wouldn't say law.
Okay. But competitive. But competitive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they've, I guess, developed a reputation for delivering on time and on budget.
Yes, and on budget, yeah.
And do they then, the Chinese, collaborate with Kenyan architects? You know, is the design often done here, or is the design done...
Majority, the designs are done here. Like, for example, when they were doing the SGR, the Standard Gauge Railway, all the railway stations and all the buildings and outbuildings along the railway line were designed by local architects.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping to take the railway later this week just to see the and so that's fascinating that they're actually. So I've seen a lot. I mean, it's fascinating in China the expansion of Chinese high speed railway lines.
Yes.
And obviously designed by Chinese architects and Chinese. But it's interesting that China are collaborating then with local architects for the stations.
And even the railway line, the design itself, they are also incorporating local engineers for purposes of supervision.
Right,
And quite a number of engineers locally were involved. Okay. Yeah. And even the new University of Nairobi Towers, it was a competition which was run locally. And one of the Nairobi firms, Waweru and Associates, won the competition and they designed the building.
Okay.
But the Chinese were the contractors.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah. And then Kenyan architects now starting, spoken to a few people who are talking about themselves starting to work overseas, you know, work across East Africa in Uganda and Rwanda and a bit more difficult maybe in Tanzania.
Yes.
But that, I guess, marks a kind of growing confidence, does it, do you think, of the industry here, that Kenyan architects are now able to...
No, they are. They are. In fact, I was in Kigali recently, and a lot of the architectural firms in Kigali are really run by Kenyan architects.
Right, okay.
And a lot of architects also from this country work in Uganda, in Seychelles and Mauritius.
Right, okay.
Tanzania have a bit of... difficult to enter, and if you enter, then the local person must have a bigger share,
right?
And that doesn't come in terms of a business model.
No, it doesn't work.
It's not very very encouraging.
Okay,
But
lots of people then have said Rwanda is quite open to interesting architecture and is quite is that the impression that you get that they're open to new ideas architecturally?
Rwanda is open to new ideas, but you see the Rwandan regime is such that the state has a major, it's like a major stakeholder.
Okay.
So it's really guiding.
A little bit like China.
Really. A little bit like China.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. You know, the National Resistance Movement is the main driver of whatever is happening.
Right.
Unlike Kenya, where the state is playing a very minimal role now.
Okay.
In fact, in Kenya today, a lot of the construction is private industry.
Right, That's interesting.
Yeah.
A bit like in the UK then, most architects are working for private contractors.
Yeah, although the bigger projects normally state.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then so we talk in London a lot about trying to influence government and to try and persuade government about the benefits of architecture and the benefits of quality design.
Yes.
Is there, I mean, I suppose the Association of Architects in Kenya and the BORAC have an influence, do they, in sort of lobbying? Does the university do you get involved?
Yeah, we get involved in terms of legislation and policy. But in this country, I don't have the exact statistics, but more than 80% of the buildings are not architect designed.
No, you know? Okay.
So a lot of the buildings are designed outside of the architectural realm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of a space planner or something.
Even engineers or people just build or copy from
from what another building.
Seen elsewhere. And that's one of the biggest problems we have in this country.
More than 80%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And our architectural association, the membership.
Yeah.
I mean, our ratio to the population is very low.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we still need quite a lot of architects. Yeah. And also the government needs to really engage architects a little bit more. Okay. Because a lot of the collapsing buildings in this city are neither architect designed or engineer supervised.
Yeah.
So very poor quality.
Yeah. Yeah. So a bit of investment earlier on in trained professionals would save money later on.
And then another thing that has happened in this country in recent times is that we have lost the lower cadre, what you may call the blue collar, artisans, technicians. They are in scarce supply now because we have not been training people at that level.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have a problem.
Yeah.
So you may find a good design, but the finishing is wanting.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that maybe, I guess, is why private organizations are looking to Chinese contractors.
Yes,
is that
one of the reasons? Yeah, one of the reasons, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And coming back then to your teaching,
yes.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I've read somewhere, I think on the Architects Association of Kenya, of Architects of Kenya, about, I think the last time I looked, 800 registered architects.
Yes.
I think there's more.
800.
More than 800 now.
More. Yeah.
Right. So it's increasing.
I wouldn't know the number.
No, I'll check.
But definitely more than 2,000.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. So increasing very.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're teaching 800 students here, you can see how the numbers
are. We graduate on average about 50 students every year.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture graduate another 25 to 30.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then now the Technical University also is beginning to graduate. I think they have graduated two cohorts.
Right. Okay.
So you could say we pour about close to 100
architects, 100
graduates.
Every year. Okay.
Close to 100 graduates every year. And not all of them go and practice architecture.
No. Okay. Yeah.
So you may find maybe about 50% of that number
end
up practicing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's that tells a positive story, I guess. The more architects, the more opportunity there is for buildings here to be designed by architects.
Yeah, and then now what you may also want to know is that when we promulgated the new constitution in 2010, we created the counties.
Yeah.
So we have 47 counties in the country.
Okay.
And all these 47 counties are almost autonomous.
Right, okay.
They are like autonomous regional governments.
Okay.
Yeah? And therefore, they are demanding to have architects.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and some, I guess, are more interested in architecture than others, have more of a commitment.
Right.
Are there some cities that are more interested in architecture?
It depends on the leadership. What kind of governor they have.
Okay.
But I think it's also a requirement for the counties now to have master plans and to document whatever they are doing.
Okay.
So inevitably, even if the governor may not be so keen architecturally.
Yeah, if they have to have a master plan.
They will have to engage.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, some of your graduates, some of the new architects coming through, they will be working on some of those master plans and those...
In fact, now most of the counties are beginning to employ... Yeah, not all have
their own,
but they are. And another thing, because of that, our graduates don't miss work.
No, okay, they could always find work
if they want.
Yeah,
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
If they want to work
within,
in the profession.
Within the first 1 or 2 months of graduation.
And I suppose that then makes it more attractive to train to be an architect because you know there's work coming.
Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, also most students... by the time they are in their fourth year of study, they are able to get attachment and vocational employment with the architectural firms.
So
by the time they are graduating, they are already...
they know exactly how business works.
They are already,
So I'm interested then in sort of the... I mean, it's a very complicated identity, I guess, Kenya, architecturally.
Yes.
So much of Nairobi having been built by, designed by foreigners.
Yes.
And I'm kind of interested in how you as a university respond to that kind of external influence and how you now design buildings with a Kenyan influence, you know, how that...
What we do, like now in this school, we teach history and theory of architecture, and the kind of curriculum I went through myself was completely Eurocentric, Western-oriented. But right now we're beginning to emphasize on African cultures.
Right.
So we're going back into history and beginning to bring about this, you know, traditional African architecture.
Okay.
Yeah. And how it can be adapted in the city.
Yeah.
It is not a very easy transition, because you find that the foundations of our urban architecture were basically Eurocentric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's very little in the way of a kind of a built legacy as a reference, almost, to try and point out the references.
Yeah. But quite often you begin to see some of the new coming emerging settlements. Yeah, you begin to see some of these local traditions coming in.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, you can have some bold clients who insist that I want it traditional.
Yeah.
And then that way you're able to do.
And is that coming about more now, do you think?
It's coming about more, but more in the resort hotel area.
Right, yeah. Okay.
The more urban residential areas seem to be fairly rectilinear.
Okay.
The curvilinear forms are working very well in the more resort, you know, touristic kind of places.
That's interesting then, tourists from abroad wanting a more traditional Kenyan architecture and maybe Kenyans themselves still being happy or still for accommodation, maybe looking for the kind of...
Yeah, but it's also the training
because
you are trained with a Eurocentric set
and
you are told this is modern.
Yeah.
Okay. And to be modern was the way to be.
Yeah.
You get me?
Yeah.
So it's like you're getting away from the tradition.
Yeah.
And to turn it back, it's not that easy.
No, it takes a long time.
It's not that easy.
Yeah. That's fascinating. It's really interesting as to what people want and what people look up for.
Yes.
I suppose you see that in where a lot of buildings going up in the Middle East, in Dubai, and looking at people want modern skyscrapers and how do you interpret.
Yes. And whether it is appropriate or not is another matter.
Yeah.
For example, in Rwanda, they had this policy of getting rid of grass thatch houses. Yeah?
Yeah.
And that was a Kagame movement.
Okay.
And so all the grass thatch houses were
just wiped away.
Yeah. And people were given free, almost free or subsidized.
Okay.
Corrugated iron sheet or other building materials to be modern.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, that's sort of the, I guess, some of the things that happened in London when what they call the kind of informal settlements, the slums in London were cleared and people were told, this is modern, this is how you should live.
Yeah.
And now people are finding actually they're quite, you know, that was a mistake maybe in some of the...
But you see in London, okay, if my history tells me right, they had a lot of catastrophes, the diseases, the fires and all that. The Public Health Act had to come in and control this.
Absolutely.
That's one of the problems we suffer here. Because our informal settlements are really bad. Fortunately, or is it unfortunately, we haven't had a major disaster for the government to be proactive.
To take action.
To take action.
Yeah. And that's, so how much does that kind of come into how you kind of informal settlements, you know, people building their own homes and building their own settlements, how much does that feature in the architectural training the study of?
We our students spend, at least when they're in their fifth year of study, they spend a whole semester just looking at informal settlements.
Right.
And settlements in general.
Yeah.
But there is a misnomer about informal settlements in Kenya that it is self-built. It is not.
Okay.
These are, we have what we call slumlords.
Slumlords. Right,
So a lot of the people who live in these informal settlements are actually tenants.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
They are tenants. They don't pay themselves. So it's an informal economy which is enriching a few. And actually giving poor housing to a majority of the citizens. Yeah.
And trapping them almost in that...
In that cycle of poverty. And then, of course... some of these settlements occur mostly on public land, which is invaded. These slumlords invade these lands,
yeah,
and then build these structures for an income.
And then very hard. So the land is still owned by the public.
It's still public.
But then very hard for government or anyone else to make changes.
Yes, it's very hard because, again, you have to understand from a political point of view, these are voters, finally.
Yeah.
So you don't want to destabilize them.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yes. And then other sort of housing, maybe a sort of more middle class developing.
Yes.
In Kenya, how do most people, what's the kind of general housing stock for most Kenyans
for
here?
The middle class, mostly, most of them, particularly on the outlying areas, on the periphery of the city, people buy their small plots.
Okay.
Then they engage a consultant.
Okay.
Or sometimes they don't engage and they build on their own.
Okay.
So that's what has happened. But in the inner city now, Kileleshwa area and Lavington area, which used to be low density.
Yeah.
Now, what is happening there? These areas are really transforming. We're getting these apartment blocks.
Okay.
Some are even going up to 10 floors.
Wow.
Yeah? And that is becoming like the trend now.
Okay. Wanting to live in apartments now.
And closer to the city.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, the land owners also know that the value of the land is so high.
Yeah.
So to build their single-story structure is a misuse of the land.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Because the building is less than the land value.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting. We've covered a lot there about Kenya more broadly. I was interested then in you and your study of architecture.
Yeah.
What led you to study? You were born in Nairobi, were you?
No, I wasn't born in Nairobi. I was born in Western Kenya.
Okay.
But I came to Nairobi very early in 1960. I lived here for a while, then went back to the village. And then I went to school in Eldoret and Mombasa before I came to the University of Nairobi.
Okay. So moved around Kenya quite a lot from...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then
after I studied here, as I told you earlier, I worked for Richard Hughes and Partners.
Yeah.
But in 1983... there was very little work, so I exited, if I may use the word.
Okay.
I went to study for my master's at the Helsinki University of Technology.
Okay.
Now it's called Alvar Aalto University.
Yeah, named after. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Okay.
So I studied there for 2 years and came back with my master's of architecture.
Right.
And then that's when I started teaching here.
Okay.
But
and the influence there of Finland.
Yes.
What sort of impact did that make on
you? No, it was quite powerful. In fact, Finnish architecture is quite fine.
Yeah.
If I may use the word.
Yeah.
It's quite fine. And it influences you.
Yeah.
So even as you design, you may not be conscious.
Yeah.
But it's impacting on you. Yeah.
Okay.
And then of course when I came back I also got stuck in academia.
Yeah.
In terms of vertical transition academically.
Right. Okay.
So I was a senior lecturer way back in 95.
Yeah.
And I got stuck.
Okay.
I couldn't move beyond that.
Okay.
So now I had to go and do a PhD.
Yeah.
So I went to study for my PhD at the Oslo School of Architecture.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So back to Norway.
Yes,
then.
In Norway. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was.
So quite a Scandinavian influence there, kind of.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of. But also, I think I created linkages.
Yeah.
So it was easier
to make contact.
To make contact,
But a hugely different, I mean, if people are influenced by their climate and their country, I mean, a hugely different climate to move to.
Of course.
For designing.
The winter is harsh.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I don't think anybody, they say they're enjoying winter sports and all that, yeah? But I would rather have summer all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it also, in terms of architectural practice, the discipline and the way to control, it becomes very critical. The trouble we have done here, we are, a lot of our younger architects are copying Western examples like the Dubai type.
Yeah.
Without contextualizing or localizing it. Nothing
wrong
with borrowing a good idea, but bring it here and contextualize it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things you try to teach.
That's what we teach here all the time.
Okay.
Like just a simple thing like orientation of the building.
Yeah.
If you orient your building with a long facade with the narrow facade, east to west,
yeah.
you have solved a lot of the environmental issues, the sun,
yeah.
heat ingestion and all that,
yeah.
Yeah, and lighting.
Okay.
Yeah. So just a simple, simple orientation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So if you put your windows on the western side, you'll rust in the building.
Yeah.
Or you'll be requiring some kind of mechanical ventilation, mechanical controls.
And is there, you say that's part of the teaching here.
Yes.
Is the university, I mean, in London, it's interesting, or in the UK, lots of universities have different, you might say, specialisms or are known for teaching particular styles.
Yes.
So we were talking, I was talking to Franklin at Kenyatta University, who talks about his interest in materials and kind of, and that perhaps coming through as part of their teaching.
Is
the University of Nairobi known for a particular way of teaching or a particular style of teaching?
Yeah, now here we're really focusing on environmental issues.
Right.
Yeah, environmental design.
Okay.
And the genesis of this is from the AA school,
right.
Tropical Architecture.
Okay. Tropical.
That's where they started it.
Right.
Yeah, and they ran it for a long time. I think it wound up in 1971.
Okay.
But we're trying now here to really bring it up, because if you look at the earlier buildings in Nairobi from the 60s, late 50s, 60s, and up to 70s, environmentally they perform very well. Without,
really?
You don't even require mechanical ventilation.
No,
And artificial,
And
artificial lighting.
Yeah,
you get it. So you can get natural lighting.
Yeah.
You can get ventilation without having to use ACs.
That's interesting. They're effective. I guess my initial view was they were just buildings that were transplanted, without much.
No.
But they are effective. They're effective. Some of them.
Okay. In fact, the ones, if you walk on Harambe Avenue, I think that is one of the largest concentration of modern architecture buildings.
Okay.
And majority perform very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
From about the period of
from the 50s, late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And majority were designed by the public works, who were then having a lot of expatriate staff coming in from Europe. Yeah, the English were majority, but the Danes were also there.
Really?
The Finns were also there, and the Norwegians were also there.
And is that part of, was that part of your, obviously when you're thinking about going overseas for your master's, was that part of, what was it that drew you to Finland and then to Norway?
No, what happened is that in the early 80s, late 70s to early 80s, Finland started collaborating with Kenya.
Right.
FINIDA, through FINIDA.
Okay.
And one of their technical assistants was to bring staff to teach at this school.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So you made the connection.
Yes, here.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's how I ended up going to...
Right, okay. So
early,
I mean, that's interesting how... I'm thinking a little bit. I mean, I've been working here with the British Council, and they're trying, I guess, to make connections between... between people here and people back in the UK.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
And are there, do you have any other kind of, as a university then, kind of formal links now with other universities, to students here?
Yeah, we have collaborated with ETH Zurich.
Okay.
And Basel.
Yep.
Yeah, we've done even some collaborative work with our students and theirs.
Okay.
And also MIT.
Wow, in the States.
MIT, yes. Yeah. And then, of course, we have a general collaboration with the University of Cambridge. A lot of our students go for their MPhil and PhD
in
environmental design.
Right,
That's
interesting. So it's a wider, School of Architecture here is part of the wider...
global network.
Okay.
Yeah.
But actually in the university, is it part of a... It sits by itself, does it, the architecture school? Or is it part of a spatial planning or environmental?
No, we have... Architecture is just a small department here.
Okay.
We have the School of the Built Environment, which is domiciled here.
Yeah.
And the school has architecture, has planning, and it has what we call now real estate. But real estate really produce quantity surveyors, valuers, and project managers.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we also have a small school within here, the School of the Arts and Design.
School of
Arts and Design.
Arts and Design.
Focusing on the arts and design.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what then? Sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit now with my questions. I might edit them together after. But it was kind of interesting what inspired you to become an architect, really, in terms of... I've spoken to people now, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it's a kind of a different environment for people, for your students. You know, what inspires them to become architects? What was it that drew you into becoming an architect?
I went through a technical school, a Rift Valley Technical School in Eldoret.
Okay.
Then I also went to Mombasa Polytechnic, currently Technical University of Mombasa.
Okay.
And through that technical training, I got that orientation, you know, drawing and design already at my hands.
Yeah.
And then while at Mombasa Polytechnic, I also worked at Bamburi Cement. Bamburi is a cement manufacturing company at Mombasa, where I used to work on the factory floor.
Right.
Working on the machine, lathe machine, as a machinist. Yeah.
Right. So proper heavy work.
Heavy mechanical work.
Okay.
And I started saying, when I grow up, this is not the kind of work I want.
Okay.
You get me, that exposure.
I do,
When I grew up.
And so you realized that fairly early. Young age.
When I was about 16,
okay,
I decided this is not the kind of work I would want to do. So when I did my A levels, advanced A level at Mombasa Polytechnic, I had to choose either engineering or architecture.
Right.
That was. Then I was thinking to do civil engineering, because civil engineering would keep me away from a factory floor. At least I can be in the field, you know. But I then said, no, let me not do engineering.
Okay.
And that's how I came into architecture.
That's fascinating. And how is, I'm kind of interested then in how architecture as a profession is seen in Kenya.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about the professions, people who train as doctors and as lawyers and accountants.
Yes.
Is architecture seen in the same in terms of its reputation?
Yes, architecture is rated quite highly.
Okay.
But sometimes it's a misconception.
Yeah.
A lot of people out there, lay people, think that if you become an architect, you become very rich. That you make a lot of money. Well, it's not true.
No.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the same in Britain. I'm interested then really in... that's architecture in London, around the world, is never really a way to get rich.
No.
But a lot of architects are, by their nature, very interested in how, socially minded, you might say, interested in how people live is that, do you see that here? People's kind of interest in...
the kind of students we get, for example, it's a mixed bag.
Okay.
Yeah. Some are coming with this monetary drive.
Okay, the business side of architecture.
Business side of architecture. Yeah. And another half or say 30% are really interested on how people live and this focusing on improving the environment of people. So, but finally, in the field, you'll find the money-sided type of architects.
You'll find the what? Sorry,
the ones who are driven by money.
Yeah. Okay.
The money sided.
Yeah. No, the money side. Okay.
Money-sided ones.
Yeah.
Seem to perform better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they go in the business world and
And they. Yeah. And so how much teaching is there about that business side of architecture as part of your program?
No, we have a few theory courses.
Okay.
Building course.
Yeah.
Building economics.
Yeah.
We teach quite a bit of that. And then, of course, when you go to the practice during the two-year pupillage.
Okay. That's when you learn.
That's when
you
learn.
The job.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like learning on the job.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I know we need to start wrapping up shortly. I'm just kind of interested then in that process of, I guess, a lot of really interesting architecture often starts with quite small, creative firms.
Yes.
And I'm interested in the, we're speaking to Nairobi Design Week and about an emerging design culture maybe in Kenya.
Yes.
Are you seeing kind of smaller startup architecture firms doing new and interesting things here?
What is happening? The big firms tend now to be just going through the motions.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
They've done this before.
Losing their creativity.
Yeah, then they just, you know.
Yeah.
Panel beat.
Yeah.
Panel beating.
Yeah. Churn out another building.
The panel beat what they had done before.
Yeah.
But the smaller farms, I think, are giving opportunity. Okay. And some younger architects don't even want to go to the big farms because they won't get the opportunity to design.
Yeah. And that creativity is...
And then, of course, when you are in a smaller farm, quite often you're making the decisions yourself.
Yeah.
And thus you take responsibility.
And that's more exciting for another generation of architects coming through to have those opportunities.
Yeah. If you go in a bigger office, you'll be working under a hierarchy of command.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes your decision may not hold.
Overruled. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm interested that just about how there's obviously a lot that you're teaching. In architecture, you're teaching people how to draw, how to think, how to do business.
Yes.
But you're also teaching, which is quite a hard thing for non-architects to understand, really, teaching creativity, teaching kind of creative thinking.
Yes.
How do you teach that?
You know, it's very difficult in the studio.
Yeah,
we spend a lot of our time, 60% of architectural training we spend in the studio. And within the studio, that's when we inculcate this culture. And you inculcate it by showing example. Okay. Yeah. So you go into history and you see how people did stuff. Yeah. And you tell them, in our situation like this, we can borrow from this without replicating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so, it's a long process. And then, of course, we have what we call the crits.
Yeah.
Where you run your work to a certain level, you pin up.
Yeah.
And we critique.
Yeah. And you defend.
And you defend. And okay. Yeah. And then you begin to get the ropes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that style of crits, I guess, is similar in architectural education.
I think it's universal.
The world. Yeah.
I think it's universal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And hard. I mean, hard work at that, I guess. You're being people learning how they defend their work and they.
By doing that, you know, we are not just teaching you how to design.
Yeah.
We are also teaching you how to communicate.
Yeah.
And you must also build on your verbal skills.
Yeah.
Because you are going to present to people and you want to convince them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need to develop that.
Yeah.
And then also, you just have to become also strong enough.
Yeah.
As an individual.
to take criticism.
To take criticism.
Because you'll take criticism from you clients or from...
Yeah.
So it's about building people's... Resilience.
And character. And character.
Yeah.
And we say architecture is 10% intellect and 90% sweat. Because to make your idea really work, you must really engage.
Must
really engage. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, really interesting talking. You mentioned the verbal skills. We're been amazed at speaking to architects and people here and their ability to explain and to tell some fantastic stories for us. So thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
You're
That's
welcome.
Really, really appreciated.
You're Thank welcome.
You. You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Professor Tom Anyamba. You can find out more about Tom and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed this programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. Music for this week's episode was by Peter Lagono and Raw Music International Kisumu Mixtape, available via the Free Music Archive and released under a Creative Commons license. In Nairobi, I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.